morning and welcome to the Athenaeum Review podcast. I'm Ben Lima, and I'm very happy to be joined this morning by Brian Allen, who's had a distinguished career as a curator and museum director and is now a full-time art critic. He's written for many journals, including, I'm happy to say, Athenaeum Review, and now he is full-time critic for National Review. Brian, thank you very much for being on this podcast.
It's nice to be here, Ben.
Well, I thought I'd start by asking if you always had a desire to do art criticism, which, you know, you can't necessarily do if you're a museum director, or if you sort of decided later on that this was something that you wanted to spend time doing.
Well, it's no, I had no inkling that I would be doing something like this. It just happened out of the blue and on the high seas of all places. And yeah. In retrospect, it makes it's made a lot of sense.
Yeah.
So it's serendipity, as so much of life is.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I know one of the things that I particularly appreciate, and I read a lot of art criticism, but I really value the sense that so much of the knowledge that you have from your career kind of on the inside, I get an insight into kind of the way things work and the way things are set up that I wouldn't if it were written by someone who'd never kind of worked in museum. And so I wondered if, you know, when you're looking at a show and thinking about it and writing about it, do you notice that your background kind of comes into what you have to say about it, or sometimes?
Sure. I bring to this what Whistler called a lifetime of experience.
Yeah.
That really goes back to when I was in my 20s, before I went to graduate school. I had a long career in political life in Connecticut. And one of the things about politics is so much of it is communications and marketing and clarity of communications. So that has stayed with me over what's now, you know, 40 years. Mm. And so I when I go into an exhibition, I look at how the themes are communicated and how clear they are and how coherent they are. But that helped me when I was a curator and I was a museum director also.
Yeah. And one of the things that I enjoy is seeing always, I mean, it seems almost every piece, there's several appreciative comments at the end. And I wondered if you had, if you noticed in your experience now, that the kind of the audience is a slightly different one than the one that you had when you were at the museums, or it seems like there might be a lot of people out there who are eager to read, who aren't necessarily art lovers already, but they come across your column, your review, and really enjoy it.
Well, National Review had never had an art critic before.
Right.
And so I was building a readership from scratch.
Yeah.
And it's a journal that's distinguished, and it's 60 years old, and it's historically significant, and still has a big readership. But I don't think there are very many people even today who subscribe to National Review to read art criticism.
Right.
And so I had to look at who the existing readership was, and they're mostly people who are interested in politics, but also are interested in money,
yeah.
the marketplace,
yeah.
Business, current events, and museums aren't insulated from any of these things by any stretch, and the art market isn't. So in looking at my subjects, I write a lot about the art market. I write a lot about trusteeship, because many of the readers of National Review are trustees, if not for art organizations, for some other not-for-profit.
Yeah.
And I write about the peccadilloes of the art world.
Yeah.
And that has taken a good bit of courage here and there. But you know, my loyalty is to my readers and offering an engaging product for them. And so bit by bit by bit over the last 5 years, I built a readership, and I'm very proud of that.
It's really impressive. You know, one of the things I was, you know, that's, I'm just curious about your perspective is sometimes with journalism in general, you know, people observe that, like journalism, like so many professions today, is sort of increasingly monopolized by people who are all kind of educated in the same way and think the same way and so forth. And some of the kind of interesting perspectives from a generation ago aren't there. But as regards art criticism, you know, sometimes I wonder whether, in fact, and this is crazy, since I, you know, I'm invested in the field of art history, but, you know, I feel like, does one necessarily, I mean, it's good to have a degree in art history if you're going to say something about art. On the other hand, it's always interesting to see what someone has to say who you know, maybe they haven't taken the classes, but they can respond to a work of art. So I don't know if you've thought about kind of the state of art criticism and how, you know, who's doing a good job or things like that, aside from yourself.
Well, I've thought about my own niche, which there's no one, I think, writing for a national publication who's got a PhD,
yeah,
or who was a curator, was a museum director. So when I go into an exhibition or I talk to an artist, go to an art fair, I see things that other people don't see. And that goes back to the lifetime of experience, but they see things that I don't see.
Yeah.
And you can't, take away from someone like Roberta Smith, who doesn't have a PhD, as far as I know.
Yeah.
But she's been going to exhibitions, mostly in New York, for 40 years. And so she's got a wealth of experience and has seen a niche of the art, part of the art market, grow and develop. And I respect that. And someone like Peter Sheldahl or Karen Wilkin, these people have an immense amount of experience, but they have seen only, they write about only a slice of the art world. They don't do art shows, as far as I know.
Yeah.
And they don't get out there in the country. That's a great big country, and there's great art, and not so great art, everywhere. I just came back from Salt Lake City and Phoenix, and you know, it's a different art scene from New York, of course, and but there are things to see there that are worth writing about, and perspectives that are worth plumbing. And as an art critic, I've got to be open to that and look for that and be receptive to it and not look at, well, because it's in Phoenix or because it's in Kansas City or Salt Lake City. There's a lot of quality to be found out there.
Yeah. I remember, I mean, fairly recently, I think there was a series, a couple of pieces in a row, there was, you wrote about Youngstown, Ohio and Toledo, Ohio. And I had the thought at the time, I thought, I've been reading our reviews for a long time. And have I ever read about Youngstown and Toledo? And, you know, I think a lot of people who love art just sort of pick up the idea, well, I'm going to go to New York or London or Paris or Rome or whatever. If I, you know, I'm going to make an art pilgrimage, which is great. And it's an amazing thing. But, you know, it's, I feel like people might overlook, unfortunately, some of these things more than they should.
Well, there are also, well, in Youngstown, when I went to the Butler, and I had never been there.
Yeah.
And I'm an art historian, Americanist, but I had never been there. And they were kind of shocked to see me. But there were a lot of nuggets there. Youngstown at one point was a very wealthy, art savvy place, and of course in Butler they had someone for whom this was his cause, his calling, to set up a museum. But there are a lot of great places. The other thing is, I don't write and this is what I think another thing that makes me unique, I don't write just about art museums. I write about history museums. I've got
presidential,
presidential libraries. I've got a piece coming up on a botanical garden.
Yeah.
I haven't done a children's museum yet.
Okay.
I'm girding my loins to do that. That's not intuitive for me.
Right. I was also, something that I had in the back of my mind was, there's, you know, because I've occasionally written some art criticism myself, and I sometimes think, well, you know, there's the objective side where you have to kind of explain, like, what is this? What is actually, what are people looking at? What will they see? You know, is it painting or sculpture, and, you know, whatever. But then there's kind of the subjective side of what, you know, what kind of experience it creates as a, and I've often noticed, and this both in the classroom, but also occasionally in journalism, like, a lot of writers who aren't necessarily trained will gravitate towards the kind of just the facts, because in a sense it's kind of easier. You could say this is born, sure, this, you know, oh, day, yeah, this movement. But if I'm just reading something and it just goes through the facts, I think, well, I mean, I could just kind of look that up. I don't need to read this person writing about it. Whereas what makes, I think, good criticism so memorable often is when there's such a strong point of view. And I wondered if you had any thoughts on kind of how to kind of cultivate or develop a certain point of view that makes it interesting to read, as yours always are.
Well, I bring a point of view. I've been, I was in the museum world for 30 years, and I have strong views on things like museum buildings. I do try to put aside my personal likes and dislikes, my personal taste. And I do like the chance, for instance, of reviewing Asian art shows, because it's something that I learn nothing about. So my perspective there is different. I'm going into an exhibition, for instance, I wrote a few weeks ago about an exhibition at the Asian Society on 19th century Japanese art, about which I knew nothing. So I go in with my novice hat on, and I look at how effectively the themes of the exhibition, which are spelled out in the introductory panel, you don't have to be an expert to understand the themes, to perceive the themes, how effectively these are communicated. To be a good curator, it's you have to be a good scholar, but the flip side of that coin is you have to be a good teacher. There are two sides of the same coin. You can be the biggest brainiac in your obscure field, but if you can't communicate it and get people excited about it, what is the point of having all of that knowledge?
Yeah.
So as a novice, that's the only perspective that I can have, because I'm not an expert. There are fields that and artists that I do know a lot about, and so that's a different kind of criticism. I look at exhibitions on Sargent or Homer or Renoir, where I have some depth, and I can be more picky and more incisive without, and I try to do this without losing the general interest reader. It's easy to get lost in the woods, but as a critic, I'm very focused on whether curators do get lost in the woods, and they get so fixated on their very narrow point that they end up not teaching anybody anything.
That reminds me, I think one of the things, as I mentioned, I look after your pieces, the comments are always so appreciative from the readers, and I feel like part of that is when I read a piece, it doesn't, I mean, it's clear that you have your views, but it doesn't quite feel like you're trying to kind of hammer us into seeing it your way.
No,
you're kind of laying
no.
it out there, and then people can take away what they want to take away.
Well, there's an element of ranting that I do from periodically, often.
Yeah.
But that's part of my MO, and that's part of what distinguishes me. A lot of critics are very bland and very banal. They won't say anything that's negative, but what kind of critic are you? There are some shows that are some, then there are some ideas, and there's some art that's bad. There's all different kinds of bad, but people don't want to be fed pablum week after week. But I try to avoid becoming a crank.
We should all, I remember, actually, I know that you wrote about this as well. It was a few months ago, the Brooklyn Picasso show. I remember there was a big attack on it in the New York Times, and then there was a response, and I took note of it partly because I thought, oh, it's a little the kind of passionate debate, critical debate, it kind of happens less often than maybe I wish it would. People have strong views and they're arguing,
sure.
And I find it's very enlightening to see why people take one view or the other. But that doesn't happen if everyone is just kind of mild-mannered.
Well, I think a lot of critics aren't able to, because they don't have, they aren't able to pick apart a show, because they don't have the depth of knowledge. It's not rocket science, really.
Yeah.
If you read a good catalog accompanying an exhibition, has got to be scrutable to not a broad cross section of humanity, but it's got to be something that an intelligent and conscientious art lover can read and appreciate it. In the case of the Pablo Matic exhibition at the Brooklyn Museum, I had never heard of the comedian.
Hannah Gadsby.
I never heard of her.
Yeah.
But I did. It takes a lot of research and a lot of work to do these things. I submitted myself to 2 hours of her of her comedy shows.
Yeah.
And I mean, is she my cup of tea? No, of course not. Do I think she's funny? No. I don't think she's funny at all, but I listened to what she had to say, and I read all of the labels, and I read the catalog, and she's a bit of a shock jock, and she didn't say anything that I thought was worth saying, but you know, I didn't slam the show, which a lot of people did, because the art was really good, and there was a lot of good stuff that was, there's a lot of great stuff that was by Picasso, but there was a lot of good stuff that was there by women artists who were working in the 70s and 80s, and it's good to see their work. Most of them I knew who they were, but many yeah. of them I didn't. So yeah. to me, overall, you could go to that show and have a good experience, but after a little bit, you just filter out Gatsby, because she really didn't have anything new to say or interesting to say.
Right. Well, I also, you mentioned, obviously, your kind of original academic background was, you had the focus on American art, but now you can see so many different things. And I wondered if you, do you still keep a particular interest in American art, or are you happy to just kind of go broadly and see anything and everything that appeals?
Well, one of the things about, I start as a naturally curious person, which you can't as a critic, or you can't go through life, even though a lot of people do, with blinkers on. I'm curious about other people, other cultures, other countries, other ideas. And the other thing is, when I was a curator at the Clark, I came to be as the curator of American art, but at a place like the Clark, which has had only three curators, I think, if I remember, you have to know a lot, not only about your narrow field, but you have to know a lot about French Impressionism, about Durer.
Yeah.
Old Master Prince, you have to know a lot about Sargent, you have to know a lot about Homer. That's just the nature of working in a small institution. Even when I went to the Addison, as director, I wasn't dealing with Homer and Sargent. I was dealing with 300 years of American art, including lots of living artists. Now, at the Clark, all the artists were dead. Yeah. And I had never worked with a living artist, so I learned a lot, but you have to be open to it.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that I mentioned, it's really impressive, just the sheer, the breadth of both travel and kind of the range of things that you see and write about. It's really impressive. And so, kind of, since it's almost at the end of the year, and I know you kind of write about the year, but kind of if big picture, in terms of kind of, I wondered if there's certain things that you think that museums are generally doing very well, and or kind of big gaps or holes that they're kind of falling down on. Anything you would single out as particular strengths or weaknesses of kind of what's going on out there at the present time?
Well, I write a lot about the Met.
Yeah.
And I try not to write too much. The Met is like a university, and it's the greatest museum in the world. It's got great curators. It's encyclopedic, and I could write about the Met every week, but of course I can't. I don't want to do that, and I can't do that. Where the Met, and I'll tell you, years ago, no critic ever said anything negative about the Met. Everything the Met did was wonderful, and the New York critics wouldn't criticize the Met. And there's a lot to criticize at the Met.
Yeah.
And one area where it's gone badly wrong is every temporary exhibition now has to have some racial component to it.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's got to implicate, you know, the stupid things, slavery, white supremacy, white privilege, all of this stuff.
Yeah.
And so many of these themes are forced into an exhibition. The Met also, because it's high establishment, the curators are naturally reticent and timid about just being juicy and being you know, a little bit salacious when you're doing an at the exhibition that's on view now on Manet and Degas was wonderful just because they got all those loans, which is the great strength the Met has.
Yeah.
But you know, you had these two artists who had great artists who had this very, very fraught you know, warm relationship, but toxic relationship too, mostly on the part of Degas. And you could make a potboiler novel out of this, but you know, it was kind of very blandly presented. I see that at a place like the Met. You know, the museums in the hinterlands are more they don't have that kind of burden of being high establishment, and they're a little freer. The shows that I did that I liked the most were shows where I did chat labels, which I don't know. I don't think people still do that now, but labels that are written in the first person. And
oh wow.
You know, they're easy to do because you just sit down and you just like, it's like I'm having a conversation with myself, which is another thing that distinguishes my art criticism. It's all written in the first person. I try to keep it conversational, which was my teaching style also. Because you want to you want to have a conversation, even though it's a one-sided conversation, with students, and it doesn't mean dumbing things down. It's just a different, more informal approach. I'm very careful about. You know, I don't throw out terms like Rococo because that means different things to different people without defining what I'm talking about.
Right.
So I see what's happening at the Met as one trend. I think a lot of curators now, they really don't know how to look at art. And it seems as though art bores them. Because
it's so sad.
They're running away from the object as quickly as they can, and they're getting into issues of race and class and gender, and many of them are parroting lines or ideas or lingo that's 40 years old. And but they're not letting the art guide them. They're not ruled by the primacy of art. And I think there's a lot of reasons for that. The pedagogy in graduate schools is one of them. And here it comes from the Clark, the years I spent at the Clark, where it was all about close looking. And it was all about working with the objects. And There's curatorial license because you're trying to get into the mind of the artist and get into the nuts and bolts of the object, but that's where you start.
Yeah, no, that's really it's a serious situation. Well, we're almost out of time, but finally, let me just ask. I know you've got your agenda for your head. I was curious if there's anything you're particularly looking forward to seeing in the coming months, or perhaps at places that you've never visited before, or anything you that might be a highlight.
Sure, I've never am going to Maastricht, the big art fair in the Netherlands in March, and I haven't been there in 2 or 3 years. And that is the mother of all art fairs, and that one of the things that characterizes it is the fresh meat. The dealers right. have to bring fresh and magnificent and never seen before things, and that's always good to see. The other thing is the Biennale in Venice is in April, and I'll go and see that. I do like every once a year doing a swing through the a state or a part of the country. And I do want to do a swing through upstate New York.
Yeah,
which is near my home, but the Albright Knox has a brand new building. The Munson Williams Proctor in Utica is a great museum. I've never been to Rochester, but they have a fine museum. Just to see what they're doing and see the collection and write about the institutions, their financing and when I went to Phoenix last week, I had lost track of the revolving door of directors that Phoenix has had in the last 15 years. They had one director who was there for 40 years and then he retired, and they've had, I think, 3 or 4 directors in the 10 years since then. Why? I want to know why.
Yes. Yes.
So, well, I've made no friends. I live on a dirt road though in Vermont. Yeah. So this little town in Vermont, and we're surrounded by woods. And so nobody can find me.
Well, that's called integrity, I think. So, well, we've been talking today with Brian Allen, and I hope everyone listening to this will subscribe and read his reviews. And thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, Ben. You have a nice Christmas.
Thank you, you too. And this is the Athenaeum Review podcast, and you can find out more at athenaeumreview.org.